traveling light. We knew something was wrong the moment the wooden door with the glassed-in window closed and our teacher, Mr. Carter, walked to the front of the room. Standing there, slump-shouldered with a catch in his voice, he uttered the unimaginable words, "The President of the United States had been shot dead in Dallas." Most people can remember whatever quiet, mundane task they were doing on that day when they heard the news that John F. Kennedy had been assassinated. I was 17 years old, sitting in my senior year History of Western Thought class at the precise moment when our own history shuddered and changed. I sat at my desk, surrounded by the writings of some of the greatest minds that humanity has ever produced, and all I could feel was mute shock, utter horror, and a numbing disbelief. It was a Friday afternoon. That Sunday, with the TV droning in the background, Daddy came rushing into the side door from the carport while Mother was fixing lunch to tell us that someone had shot Lee Harvey Oswald, Kennedy's assassin. The report had just come over the car radio. He stood there in the kitchen shaking his head and saying how tragic it was, because now no one would ever really know what happened. There would always be speculation. We would never be certain of the truth. For the rest of that day and the Monday following, I lay on the couch in our den and watched the entire presidential funeral ceremony, the inky mourning crepe looking somehow even blacker on the grain of the black and white TV. I was aching for Mike Douglas's death. Kennedy's assassination entwined itself with my own sense of tragedy until all I felt was a smothering sadness. There is a story told 40 years later by one reporter that at a single Midland restaurant, Luigi's, an Italian pizza and pasta place, where the tables were covered in red and white check cloths, lunchtime diners applauded when they heard the news of Kennedy's murder. I never heard that, not at the time, not in the years afterward. Neither did any of my friends. The not-so-subtle implication behind the story was that Midland was fiercely conservative and more than a little racist, although many of the United States' greatest civil rights gains would come under a Texan, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Certainly Midland in the early 1960s wasn't a racially integrated town. As in most of Texas, much of the South, and indeed the rest of the country, the schools were segregated, and there was an undercurrent of racism. The Midland of my early childhood had a few separate water fountains, each porcelain basin clearly marked white or colored, but they were soon taken down. The prejudice that remained was subtler, a backroom or bridge club type of prejudice, inflicted behind closed doors. No one burned crosses or scribbled epithets or deployed water cannons. In the early 1960s, there was a small African-American section in Midland, but not yet a sizable Hispanic one. I didn't have any black friends, but I didn't have any way to make black friends, and they had no way to make friends with me. And I always knew that on that horrible night of November 6th, the first car that had stopped to help and the family that had come running up to wrap me in the protective cover of their arms was African American. My parents never doubted that I would attend college. When I was in the second grade, my father proudly announced that he had bought an insurance policy designed to pay for my college when the time came. He walked into our brick house on Estes Avenue and said, "I bought this college plan for you." When I actually went to college, that little plan was worth only enough to cover one semester, but my parents were always determined that I have a college education. That was what so many of our parents in Midland wanted, a future beyond the best of what theirs had been. And it was all the more remarkable that my father kept his promise. By the time I left Midland for Dallas and Southern Methodist University, an oil bust had struck. Some 4,500 people ultimately left the city. Homes went unsold or were foreclosed. My father did not build a single new house the entire time I was away at school. The fall of 1964 on college campuses around the country was not the spring of 1968 or 1969. Far from being hotbeds of radical activity, most schools were bastions of youthful irresponsibility, whirls of brimming punch bowls, and the nervous social banter of night after night of sorority rush in antebellum-style houses that looked like backdrops for Gone with the Wind. In our dorm rooms and sororities, we had curfews, 10 o'clock p.m. on weekdays, midnight on weekends. House mothers came to do bed checks. Irresponsibility could occur only during preset hours. We dutifully followed the rules, having no sense of the seismic fault lines that trembled beneath our feet. I lived in the women's dorms and joined a sorority, Kappa Alpha Theta, in my second year. I was only 17 when I started college, at a time when many of the girls I knew aspired more to getting married than to attending their own university graduations. We had girls who pined after loves on other campuses, and hundreds of others who were searching for lifelong mates among the fraternity boys on our own. In the beginning, I didn't know whether to be social or studious. After one semester of too many dates at the El Toro Room and the embarrassing grades that resulted, I became, if not a model student, then certainly a very serious one. And I had a tremendous advantage. I'd already studied many of the classics during my senior year course in Western Thought in Midland. While I was at SMU, I decided I wanted to be a teacher. Having a chosen profession was a rather new concept for women in the South. Women had always worked, doing the backbreaking labor of running a home, cooking, cleaning, hefting piles of sopping wet laundry onto the line to dry. And many women did work in jobs before they married, or if they were widowed young. A few in Midland, like Mary White, worked for most of their married lives, although the oil men whose offices they ran rarely promoted them beyond the typewriter and steno pool. Most girls, though, were schooled to dream of being wives and mothers. Their curious minds were largely self-taught. My bricklaying grandmother with her intricate garden, or my mother with her book open in her dishwater dry hands. When Betty Friedan published The Feminine Mystique in 1963, their lives, my life, and those of my friends were not upended. What I see now, in retrospect, is that so many of my friends broke barriers not by intention, but simply by doing. What we felt much more keenly in the mid-60s was the civil rights movement. In 1961, when I was just a high school sophomore, SMU students had already picketed local barbershops and movie theaters that practiced segregation. And even though SMU had few African-American students, the student body as a whole had voted strongly in support of a completely integrated campus where all admissions would be colorblind. The civil rights cause gave us the words to talk about the racial divide that still stubbornly clung to our cities and towns, even our own homes. Suddenly, everything was open for question. Why my father's black friends were the men who worked the stove and the grill at Johnny's Barbecue, or why the only black women the rest of us knew were the ones who cleaned homes. I was not a placard-waving protester, but the scenes from the Alabama marches or the riots that left Detroit and Newark in flames cemented my desire to do what I could, and that was to teach in an inner-city minority school. I wanted to work with children who'd been left out and too often left behind simply because of the color of their skin. When I taught, I always asked to be placed in what were called minority schools. Even if there was no summer of love at SMU, we did know that there was another world being unleashed beyond our white columns and red brick walls. A few students played tracks from the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper or Light My Fire by Jim Morrison and The Doors, although at parties we danced to the sounds of what is now Motown, but was then called soul music. The Supremes, the Isley Brothers, and Cookie and the Cupcakes. Once, during my senior year, I was curious to see what real hippies looked like. My roommate Jane and I dressed in jeans and bare feet and hung beads from our necks. Then we headed off to Lee Park, one of the largest parks in Dallas and named for Robert E. Lee, to look for the fabled hippies. But there were none. Instead, everyone else in the park turned to stare at us, imagining that we were the hippies who had come to commune with nature in the middle of the city. One thing we did in our cute skirts and bubble hair, which was teased and sprayed and rolled on big bristly rollers clamped tight with pins, was drink, even though we were underage. All the fraternity parties served alcohol, especially in lethal blends of spiked punch, and we drank way too much and smoked, even in class. By the early 1970s, our drinking would seem almost passé. By then, the drug culture had overwhelmed college life. Graduating in the South in 1968 put us just slightly ahead of the wave, but in time, alcohol would prove to be equally devastating for far too many of my friends. Many of the girls I knew, including most of my Midland friends, were getting on with the next phase of their lives. They'd become engaged or had already returned home to their childhood churches for their weddings. I fully expected to be married by the end of my senior year. I thought about it whenever I caught sight of a beaming bride preparing to walk down the aisle under the serene cream spire of Perkins Chapel at the center of the SMU campus. I even dated a young medical student at the start of my senior year and assumed for a while that I would settle down with him. But I graduated with no ring on my left hand and no immediate prospects for one. To this point, much of my gainful employment consisted of teaching swimming at the Midland Public Pool and working as a counselor at summer camps. Now I was about to set foot in a fourth grade classroom with nothing more to prepare me than a few months of practice teaching at one of Dallas's most elite elementary schools. I had decided to remain in Dallas, at least for the moment. My friends, Susan, Janet, Bobby, Joe, and I rented a little post-war style garden apartment amid a cluster of two-story brick buildings with white trim and stairs. Every morning, I walked to Longfellow Elementary, two blocks from my apartment. Longfellow had been built amid large, gracious two-story homes that sat back from the roads on acres of manicured green lawns, but very few of the local residents sent their children there. Many were older people whose children had long since grown. But the well-to-do also largely avoided the Dallas Independent School District. The students at Longfellow, a solid two-story tan brick school, were bused in from other neighborhoods close to downtown. Most came from a predominantly African-American neighborhood near the new Parkland Hospital, which had replaced the old red brick building where John F. Kennedy was rushed after he was shot. I loved my students. I was just 21 when I entered that fourth grade classroom, and my students in so many ways taught me. I had only 20 in my class, a luxury at a time when many public schools had upwards of 30 or 40 students in a single room. My classroom was on the first floor, with windows all along one side because there was no air conditioning. We opened the glass and hoped for a breeze. It was in that school in the September heat, as sweat glued my blouse to my back, that I felt the physical demands of teaching, 6 hours or more on my feet, standing at the blackboard, on the recess blacktop, or in the cafeteria as students navigated the lunch lines and down their meals. And I had to keep their attention by myself alone. My education degree had not prepared me, I quickly learned, to teach reading. Like many new teachers, I followed the textbook teacher guide provided by the school system, but that did little to make words and stories come alive. It was when I began a story hour after lunch that my passion quickly became the children's. We read books like Where the Wild Things Are, and the children would pretend that the characters had come alive in the classroom. We saved a space in the corner for a web for Charlotte, the famous spider in Charlotte's Web. Wilbur's pen was a nearby locker. Bunnies lived in supply closets. Monsters screeched on the blackboard. Every book came to life, and the children would gaze eager and wide-eyed, leaning forward as I turned each page. I had them write poems and created books of their poetry, each bound between two cardboard sheets and secured by a ribbon threaded through hand-punched holes. I would save up the funny things they said and call home to regale Mother and Daddy, who laughed at the other end of the phone. 4 decades later, the antics of my students would become the inspiration for my first book, a children's story. Read all about it, which I penned with my daughter Jenna. Like me, Jenna would begin her career as a teacher in inner-city schools, hers in Washington and Baltimore. In Read All About It, as in my first classroom in Longfellow, cherished storybook characters magically came to life. By the end of that year, though, I was ready to leave Dallas. I was 22 and restless. My students were moving on to the next grade, and it seemed time for me to move as well. My SMU friend Janet Kinert had moved from Dallas to Houston. All summer she'd been calling and saying that she needed a roommate, so I set off for Houston. After a brief and boring stint working at a brokerage firm, soon I was teaching again, taking over the class of a teacher who had left to have a baby. My school was the John F. Kennedy Elementary School. My class was the fourth grade, and our principal was Miss Gunnells. At first, I hated it. I was starting in the middle of the school year. The classroom was in chaos, and after my sweet class in Dallas, I was unprepared for this group of 9-year-olds. My students were wild, screaming, talking back, hiding erasers, wadding up pieces of paper and lobbing them across the room. They were determined to see just how far they could push a new teacher. The Kennedy School sat on a busy commercial road. Trucks, cars, and buses rattled outside the windows. The students, nearly all of whom were African American, lived for the most part in small rundown houses behind the school building on narrow side streets, which eventually dead-ended alongside warehouses and the train tracks. Most of the parents worked, but there were few opportunities available to them. Poverty, lack of education, even alcohol abuse lurked behind too many doors. But in the early 1970s, teachers were not expected to reach into families' lives. We could only try to teach our students before they moved on. There were some students we did help. One of my students was a petite girl who was constantly jumping up and down and trying to attract attention. Then we did the eye chart and found that she was just like me, partially blind. She was the way I would have been if I hadn't had glasses. I moved her to the front row, and the school nurse sent a note home saying that she needed glasses. Her mother refused to get them, but the nurse did not give up. Eventually, the child got glasses. While I was figuring out how to be a teacher, I was also learning how to be a grown-up in Houston. In our little apartment, Janet and I would host dinner parties and fix King Ranch chicken, a famous casserole of tortillas, cheese, chicken, and 3 different cans of soup. Janet's mother had sent her off with the Abilene Junior League cookbook, and we thought it was a good cookbook, since most of the recipes called for several cans of cream soup. We went to bars to drink and restaurants for dinner, because there's only so much King Ranch chicken that anyone can eat. A couple of our friends had sailboats, and we would spend afternoons blowing about on the waters of the Gulf of Mexico, traversing the foul-smelling, oil-covered Houston ship channel to sail. I lived in the place for singles, the Chateau de Jean, a sprawling block-long apartment complex with several swimming pools and turrets rising on each side. With its sloping gray roof, it had pretensions of being a brown brick Versailles. One summer I spent nearly every day at the pool reading the classics of Russian literature, traveling through the frigid snow-laden novels of Tolstoy and Dostoevsky in the swampy heat of Houston, where by mid-morning you could break a sweat simply by stepping outside. Reading and books were my passion, and I began to think seriously about enrolling in graduate school for library science. Also, as much as I loved Houston, I wanted a change. I applied to the library science program at the University of Texas at Austin and was accepted. The library school was located in the Harry Ransom Center on the UT campus, a treasure trove of rare manuscripts, from Shakespeare's First Folio to manuscripts by the Bronte sisters and John Keats, and the page proofs from James Joyce's Ulysses. I was learning about the conservation of books in a place with some of the most beautiful pieces of literature in the world. After I got my degree, I returned to Houston and a job at a branch library. But I missed Austin. I missed being able to gaze up at the edge of the Texas Hill Country, where at dusk, the sun cast a violet crown around the rising land. I enjoyed Austin's small space, its lake and trails, and I missed working in a school. I moved back to Austin and found a job as the school librarian for the Molly Dawson Elementary School in a largely Hispanic neighborhood. Now my day was spent with children and books, and class after class was my much-loved story hour. For many small children, there's a fine line between reality and fantasy, and it's easy for them to cross back and forth, just as little boys trot off to face imaginary bad guys in their Superman capes. Books and their stories help children do just that. I wanted these children, like the ones at John F. Kennedy, to dream of possibilities beyond their web of city blocks and brick school walls. My life had found its routine: work in Austin, visits to Midland a few times a year. My summer vacations consisted of a week or two of visiting mother and daddy and trips around Texas to visit friends. I was back on the flat asphalt highway between Austin and Midland, bisecting the geography of Texas, the Big Empty, as it's often known, and I was 30 years old. For at least a year, my friend Jan Donnelly's husband, Joey O'Neill, had been telling me that he wanted to introduce me to one of his friends. Joey was working in his dad's oil business, and his childhood friend, George Bush, was working as an oil landman, scouring county courthouse records for land that might be leased for drilling wells. Joey talked up George every time I stopped a visit with Jan. I was in no rush. I had a vague memory of George from the 7th grade, almost 20 years before. I knew that his dad had run for Senate and lost in 1970 when I first moved to Houston, and I assumed that George would be very interested in politics, while I was not. It was late July, one of those high-heat days when, come dusk, the sun had, as Willa Cather wrote, left behind it a spent and exhausted world. I put on a blue sundress, drove the car around the corner, and walked up to the door of Jan and Joey's brown brick townhouse. Even the roof was a cedar-shake brown. The cicadas were droning, and overlaying their vibrating wings was the steady whir of air conditioners to keep the baking hot houses cool. Joey was at the grill. It was not some elaborate party. It was just the four of us, Jan, Joey, George, and me, sitting out back eating hamburgers. We laughed and talked until it was nearly midnight. The next day, the phone rang. It was George saying, "Let's go play miniature golf," and we did, with Jan and Joey tagging along as our chaperones. The miniature golf course is one of the prettiest places in Midland. It was built among a veritable forest of old elm trees, which had grown tall and graceful, even in the West Texas ground. We played golf under the stars and laughed again. Then I went back to Austin and George started visiting on the weekends. Sometimes he'd fly over on a Friday night, or he would drive, but he came every weekend except for the very end of August, when he left for Maine to see his family. Barb Bush loves to tell the story that George spent exactly one day in Kennebunkport that summer. When he called my apartment, she says that some guy answered, and he raced for a plane and flew right back down. I returned to the library at Dawson and worked all through September. By the end of the month, George had asked me to marry him. We'd been dating only 6 or 7 weeks, but our childhoods overlapped so completely and our worlds were so intertwined, it was as if we had known each other our whole lives. I loved how he made me laugh and his steadfastness. I knew in my heart that he was the one. I looked at him and said yes. That Sunday night, when George arrived in Midland, he headed to Humble Avenue to speak to my parents. A week later, early on a Sunday morning, George and I drove to Houston for his niece, Noelle's, christening. Jeb and Columba Bush had a little house in Larchmont, a neighborhood just past the Chateau de Jean. George took my hand and led me to meet his parents. He introduced me with the news that we were getting married. After lunch at the Bush's home, George's dad pulled out his pocket calendar and looked over each weekend that fall. In a few minutes, we'd picked a wedding date, November 5th, 1977, one day after my birthday, one day before the anniversary of the awful accident, and only about 3 weeks away. There was no time even to order printed wedding invitations. Mother wrote and addressed all of ours by hand. I bought my dress and ivory silk skirt and blouse at a store called Maharani, where most of the clothing came from India or Afghanistan. I would carry a bouquet of gardenias and pin gardenias in my hair. We had no groomsmen or bridesmaids and invited only our immediate family and close friends, about 75 people, a very small wedding by Texas standards. Far more nervous than either the bride or the groom were Jan and Joey O'Neill. Joey and Jan had dated for years before they got married. Neither had dreamed that their invitation to dinner would lead us to the altar in a mere 3 months. But at that particular moment, on that warm summer night, both George and I were hoping to find someone. We were not looking for someone to date, but for someone with whom to share life for the rest of our lives. We both wanted children. We were ready to build an enduring future. Those were the facts of our lives when we went to dinner that night. It was the right timing for both of us. Of course, not everyone in Midland agreed. As I was packing to leave Austin, Reagan and Billy were selling their house. A week before the wedding, the mother of a friend of mine from Midland came to see Reagan and Billy's house. She was thinking of buying it for her daughter. She didn't recognize Reagan, but Reagan recognized her and said, "We're going to be in Midland next weekend. We're going to Laura and George's wedding." And without a second's hesitation, this woman said to Reagan, "Yes, can you imagine? The most eligible bachelor in Midland marrying the old maid of Midland." Reagan was speechless, but I thought it was funny. After all, I am 4 months less 2 days younger than George. The movers loaded up my few things. After the last box was stowed, my cat Dewey and I began the drive that I never quite imagined making, back to live in Midland. Right outside of San Angelo, I came upon a few scattered trees lining the edge of the road. Now, on the verge of November, the frost had already settled on the land, and their leaves had fallen and blown away. Trunks and branches stood dark and empty against the sky. Suddenly, from one naked tree, a great mass of winged birds lifted up, feathers pulsing, air swirling as they rose. I slowed and watched in silence as they beat their migratory way south, then glanced back at the unremarkable tree that had extended its branches for rest and refuge. The sight was like a beautiful wedding gift on the long road toward home. We were married on a Saturday morning at the First Methodist Church in Midland, the church I had gone to all my childhood, where I was baptized as a baby, where I'd learned to sing in the choir, and where my mother still went every Sunday. It was the morning after my 31st birthday. I stepped into the chapel on my father's arm. George was waiting at the altar. The stained glass windows sparkled with light, casting pretty patterns over the simple wooden chapel pews. It was, I later learned, exactly 31 steps down the aisle and into the rest of my life. We returned home from our honeymoon to George's new single-story townhouse on Golf Course Road, a street name for Midland's first and now long-vanished golf course. George had furnished the house by trading oil leases with Charlie Knorr of Knorr's Furniture. One lease had gotten him a brown leather couch. Otherwise, he hadn't done much. In his yard, a small forest of weeds had grown up as tall as the roofline. But we were not destined to hang around home. A few months before George and I met, Representative Mahon had announced his retirement from Congress after 44 years in office. The seat was open, and George was trying to win it as a Republican. Almost from the moment we arrived home, George and I hit the campaign trail, covering a big swath of West Texas. We drove up and down the back roads and asphalt highways of the Texas Panhandle, from Midland on the southern tip up to Plainview and Hereford in the north, with the New Mexican border running alongside. We spent nearly a year on the road, and in many ways the bonds of our marriage were cemented in the front seat of that Oldsmobile Cutlass. When George and I met, it was as if two parallel lives suddenly converged. Our childhood memories, the places we had known, even many of our friends overlapped. These layers of connections and commonalities forged a deeper, richer bond. We never worried that any long-buried fact about the other person would appear and surprise us. From the start, our marriage was built on a powerful foundation of trust. We had been cut, as it were, from the same solid Permian Basin stone. So we drove and we talked and we laughed and we dreamed in the front seat of George's Oldsmobile. The 19th Congressional District was a traditionally Democratic district, even if its voters had chosen Republicans for president for the last 25 years. Most people, including my parents, were registered Democrats, and the Democratic primary usually mattered more than the general election. As George H.W. Bush used to joke when he started the Republican Party in Midland in the 1950s, only three people voted in the Republican primary: Barbara Bush, himself, and a drunk Democrat who'd wandered into the wrong side of the polling place. From the start, George knew that the numbers were stacked against him, but he also knew that the 19th was a conservative district with an open seat. The election could be very close. But first, we had to make it through the primary. Because the district was large and sparse, candidates went out to meet the people, and all five of the candidates, the two Democrats, Kent Hance and Morris Sheets, and the three Republicans, George, Jim Reese, and Joe Hickok, would cross paths almost every week. Most of the time it was at local forums, held on the lawns of the county courthouses, the same courthouses that teenage boys and girls would cruise past in endless circles on a Saturday night. It was in one of these towns, Leveland, Texas, where the land lay every bit as flat as the name, that I gave my first speech, a few months after George's famous pledge to me that I would never have to give a speech, not ever. It was the only promise he made to me that he ever broke. George couldn't be at this particular candidate forum, so I went in his place and sat in a folding chair with all the other candidates in front of the courthouse. A local official introduced me and I got up to give my speech. I planted myself behind the podium, grateful for the heavy, thick wood because my legs were shaking. And then I looked up. Everyone in the audience, and even the other candidates, were nodding their heads, encouraging me the entire time. When I finished speaking, I wasn't eager to do it again, but it also wasn't nearly as bad as I'd anticipated. In fact, it wasn't much different from reading a story to my students. Out on the campaign trail, I discovered that politics is really about people, and even though I was more reserved than George, I liked meeting the oilmen, the farmers, the moms, and the store owners. I wanted to be with them and listen to their stories. During the long months before the primary, we got to know Kent Hance, the Democratic frontrunner, who was funny and smart and understood in his bones that this was a rural district. Then George won his primary and Kent won his, and the real hard-nosed politicking began. Kent launched an ad that said, "In 1961, when Kent Hance graduated from Dimmitt High School in the 19th Congressional District, his opponent, George W. Bush, was attending Andover Academy in Massachusetts. In 1965, when Kent Hance graduated from Texas Tech, his opponent was at Yale University. And when Kent Hance graduated from the University of Texas Law School, his opponent, get this, folks, was attending Harvard." We don't need someone from the Northeast telling us what the problems are. Never mind that George had spent nearly half of his life in Midland. He couldn't combat the ad. It was devastatingly effective. On election night, George won 77% of the vote in Midland County. Overall, he lost to Ken Hance by some 6,600 ballots, or about 6% of all the votes cast. We were sad, but not disappointed. Whatever plans we'd made in our minds, we'd simply have to make new ones. George went back to being a landman in the oil business, going to an office every day, and I began to set up our new home. Our lives in Midland moved along at much the same pace as our parents had. Men worked, women largely stayed home, and there were dinners out on Friday nights and dinner parties on Saturdays. With his usual single-minded focus, George set about to build his small oil business. He had gone from trading land leases to starting an exploration company of his own. But to drill wells, he needed capital. So as much as we were at home in Midland, we were also traveling to other parts of Texas, to New York, even to Scotland, so George could line up investors. And in just a few months, we were back to politics. George Herbert Walker Bush was running for president. This time, though, I was on the periphery. George left to do some surrogate speaking, but once Ronald Reagan wrapped up the nomination, we returned to our lives in Midland. Then George's father was picked as Reagan's vice president, and suddenly we were back on the campaign trail, this time stumping for Reagan and Bush. Election night was November 4th, my birthday, and we gathered in Houston. I went out to lunch with friends, and then we went to the Bushes' house on Indian Trail before the family drove to a big hotel ballroom for the results. Reagan Bush won in a landslide. Days before, many commentators had predicted a second term for Jimmy Carter. George and I and several friends flew up to Washington for the inauguration. We sat on the inaugural platform at the back of the Capitol, gazing out at the Washington Monument in the distance as the oaths of office were recited. When the ceremony ended, we were ushered inside to a lunch amid the gleaming marble columns of Statuary Hall. Suddenly, I heard the U.S. Army strings begin to play, their haunting violins unexpectedly surrounding us, and I gasped. Years later, at my own White House dinners, I would glance around to watch the enthralled expressions of our guests as a procession of strings magically appeared in the state dining room. George and I now existed in that strange netherworld of celebrity by association. In Midland, cars drove slowly past our house as locals pointed out, "This is where the vice president's son lives," to their out-of-town guests. We were vaguely someone, the children of the famous, while I had the quiet ache of having no children of my own. For some years now, the wedding invitations that had once crowded the mailbox had been replaced by shower invites and pink and blue beribboned baby announcements. I bought onesies and rattles, wrapped them in yellow paper, and delivered them to friends. I had done it with a happy wistfulness, believing that someday, my time, my baby would come. George and I had hoped that I would be pregnant by the end of his congressional run. Then we hoped it would be by the time his own father announced his presidential run. Then by the presidential primaries, the convention, the general election. But each milestone came and went. The calendar advanced, and there was no baby. The English language lacks the words to mourn an absence. For the loss of a parent, grandparent, spouse, child, or friend, we have all manner of words and phrases, some helpful, some not. Still, we are conditioned to say something, even if it's only, "I'm sorry for your loss." But for an absence, for someone who was never there at all, we are wordless to capture that particular emptiness. For those who deeply want children and are denied them, those missing babies hover like silent, ephemeral shadows over their lives. Who can describe the feel of a tiny hand that's never held? In the fall of 1980, as the white-hot presidential race was drawing to a close, George and I decided to apply to the Gladney home in Fort Worth to adopt a baby. We had friends from Midland who had been Gladney babies, and other friends who'd already adopted their own children from there. We filled out the paperwork. Mother snapped a photo of us along the fence line of our backyard. George in a brown corduroy jacket. Me in a red sweater and pleated pants. Our smiles strained but hopeful. Every time I come across that photo, it seems to say, please give this couple a baby. At the same time as we were driving to Fort Worth for our Gladney interview and tour, I started to see Dr. Robert Franklin in Houston, Texas, for hormone treatments. In April of 1981, just as we were waiting for our home visit for Gladney, I discovered that I was pregnant. I was anxious the entire time that I was pregnant. The memories of mother's late miscarriages hung over me, and I was 34 years old, which in 1981 was considered old for a first-time mother. We had so longed for children, and I was so superstitious about this pregnancy that I even avoided the baby aisle of the grocery store. The days and then the weeks passed, but I remained afraid to hope. Dr. Franklin was also worried that I might miscarry, just as mother had. The recommended treatment was cervical sutures. George and I headed to Houston for the procedure, our fingers interlaced, our hands clasped together, communicating in that one gesture every hope that we held for all the months to come. While we were in Houston, Dr. Franklin scheduled us for a sonogram, which was a relatively new technology and not at all routine. Our radiologist was a doctor named Sereni Malini, and we watched her as she studied the incomprehensible flecks of white scoring the dark gray screen. At last, she turned to look at us and said, "There are two babies." George's eyes and mine overflowed. But Dr. Malini kept staring at the screen. Her next words were, "They are not co-joined." Both of us gasped. We'd never envisioned such a thing. My mind began to race with questions, and I asked her to look to see if there were any heart defects, anything associated with Down syndrome. I had already decided against amniocentesis because we didn't want to tempt the risk of miscarriage. And these were my babies. I would love them however they came. Dr. Malini looked very closely, and then she said, "They're beautiful babies," the words I had longed to hear. We asked to see if she could tell whether they were boys or girls. She turned back to the machine and said, "I can tell that the top one is a girl, but I can't see the one underneath as well. I'm pretty sure she's a girl, but I'm not positive." The next day, I had the sutures, and I sat in my hospital bed that night, watching the highlights of Prince Charles and Lady Diana's storybook wedding, dreaming of a happy ending of my own. George had a dozen roses delivered to my room and signed the card, "With love, from the father of twins." When I first learned that I was pregnant, I had pictured two babies in my mind. My next thought was that it's greedy to want two babies, and I berated myself for even thinking such a thing. Now there were going to be two babies, if all went well. Then in early November, when I was barely 7 months along, my obstetrician found the early signs of preeclampsia. My blood pressure was dangerously high. He looked at me with a worried face and said, "I'll never forgive myself if you don't get at least one baby." He wanted me to go to Houston or Dallas, where there were neonatal intensive care units, because he was sure the babies would be born prematurely and might need special care. I chose Baylor Hospital in Dallas because my Uncle Mark was a doctor there, and the neonatologist, Dr. Dolores Carruth, was the mother of twins. George and I booked our flight. In Dallas, I was admitted to the hospital and put on bed rest. I was determined to give the babies every possible day to develop and grow. I wanted them to have whatever chance I could give them. George was traveling between Dallas and Midland, tending to me, tending to his business, finishing his job as chairman of Midland's United Way charity campaign. But I was not lonely in my hospital room. Barbara Bush scheduled an event in Texas and came to see me, and so did my Dallas friends. On November 24th, George was back in Midland hosting the final United Way luncheon when my Baylor doctor, James Boyd, called him and said, "You're going to have your babies tomorrow." George asked him, "Are you sure?" And Dr. Boyd said, "Yes, unless you want your wife's kidneys to fail." My blood pressure was too high and it was dangerous to continue the pregnancy. George rushed back to Dallas, and at dawn the next morning, I was wheeled into the operating theater for a cesarean section. George was standing next to me as they delivered the babies. Barbara came first at 5 pounds, 4 ounces, and Jenna second at 4 pounds, 12 ounces. They were 5 weeks early. We had chosen to name the girls after our mothers, and we did it alphabetically and democratically. The baby who arrived first would be Barbara. The second would be Jenna. Our girls were here and healthy, and we were thrilled. They were, quite simply, the answer to all of our prayers. I never saw Dr. Malini after that one visit in Houston when she showed us the first images of our girls. Then on July 18, 2005, George and I hosted an official dinner at the White House for the Indian Prime Minister, Manmohan Singh, and his wife, Gurcharan Kaur. For that dinner, one invitation was precious to me. I invited Dr. Malini. When she came through the long receiving line wearing a stunning orange sari, George announced to the Prime Minister of India that she was the doctor who told us we were having twins, that she was the first doctor to see our babies. Dr. Malini laughed and said, "Yes, and I've honored patient confidentiality for all of these years. I've never told anyone that I was the one who saw for the first time that you were going to have twins." I sat her at my table, and nothing made me happier than to see her beautiful smile all through dinner. It was such a small thing to give back to someone who had given us so much on that hot and anxious July afternoon. A few days after the girls were born, my father was diagnosed with lung cancer. His only hope of beating the disease was if a surgeon removed part of his lung. A friend's dad offered to send his private plane to pick George and me and the girls up when we were finally released from the hospital in mid-December. It saved us a 6-hour drive or a commercial flight with 2 premature babies. When the plane left Midland for Dallas, my mother and daddy were on board. Daddy was coming to Baylor for his surgery. I was leaving to return home to Midland. I don't remember what we said to each other. I was too overwhelmed. Life and death were balanced on the span of those 2 aluminum wings. George and I arrived home, and we were on our own. For months, I had secretly daydreamed of sitting under the Christmas tree with George and our 2 wonderful babies, like some storybook tableau. Instead, we were bleary-eyed and nervous, trying to soothe howling twins. Some nights we put them in their cribs and literally ran to the other side of the house, hoping for an hour of quiet. Eventually, driven by exhaustion and inexperience, we hired a baby nurse to help us get up with the girls in the middle of the night and to give us a chance to ever so briefly leave the house. After the girls were in their cribs, we would take long walks around Midland in the chilly, wintry darkness, arm in arm. Christmas came and went, and we adjusted. After the initial crying and the trauma of us trying to adjust to them and them simply trying to adjust to the world, both girls became happy babies. And George and I discovered a wonderful symmetry in having twins. There was always a baby for one of us to hold. Every morning before dawn, George would get up to make the coffee, as he has done from the start of our marriage. Then he would go get the girls and carry them into our bed. We'd each hold a baby and drink our coffee while they drank their bottles, with the morning news droning quietly in the background. The start of the day was reserved for just the 4 of us. Those early mornings were some of the sweetest times of our lives. The doctors had told me that many premature babies have eye problems, so when they were around 6 months old, I took both girls to an eye specialist who waved a pen light around the room and had them follow it with their eyes. He told me they were very alert girls, and I breathed a relieved sigh. They crawled early and walked by age 1, but I still remember the couple of days when Barbara acted listless. I bundled her off to Dr. Dorothy Wyvell, who had been my pediatrician and who had treated the Bush children. Every child in Midland seemed to have been poked, prodded, and tongue-depressed by Dr. Wyvell. She had gray hair now, and she remained strikingly blunt. She did an exam, ordered some tests, and looked at me. "I know why you're worried," she said. "It's to be expected." With that, she pronounced Barbara fine. Dr. Wyvell was the one who had diagnosed George's little sister Robin's leukemia when she was 3, and had told Barbara and George Bush that there was nothing they could do but make her comfortable. Leukemia was fatal, Dr. Wyvell explained, and she would slip away in a matter of weeks. Robin spent most of the next 6 months in Sloan Kettering in New York, pumped full of transfusions on the slim hope of a cure before she died. Daddy recovered from his surgery, and he and Mother began to drop by all the time to see the babies. Daddy's favorite time to arrive was right after lunch, just when I'd put the girls down for a nap. He would knock on the door, open it wide, and loudly call, "Laura, are the babies awake?" They invariably heard him, and once they could pull themselves up, they would be standing in their cribs, beaming when their grandfather opened the door. He loved to hold them on his lap, their 2 little bald heads and his big one bent over together. George loved being a dad. He changed diapers when the girls were small. He got up at night to help feed them their bottles. He would come home and think of adventures. One night, when a rare Midland snow had started to fall and the girls had just turned 3, he announced after dinner that we were going for a snow walk. We bundled the girls in their jackets and trooped off in the darkness, and as the snow shimmered under the glinting streetlights, we held up our faces to feel the flakes land one by one. And he loved to play with his daughters. One of our good friends, Mike Weiss, later told me that Georgia taught him how to play with his own kids. "My dad never played with me," he told me once. "George taught me how to be funny, how to have fun with them, and have a good time." Our lives in those years in Midland were centered on our family and our friends. Often Mother and Daddy would come for dinner. I would call Mother late in the afternoon to see what she was cooking, and we would put our meals together around our little table. I remember one summer evening, working in the flower beds in our yard after the girls had gone to sleep, while the sun still hung low in the sky. George was sitting on the steps with the newspaper, and I thought to myself, "This is the life." And it was. For the first 4 years that George's dad was vice president, we rarely went to Washington. But that physical distance also meant that we were the outliers on the Bush family curve. We were not with them for Christmas, only for summer visits in Maine, with all the other cousins and meals for a small army of Bushes and wet beach towels strewn about the Kennebunkport house. George's parents had no time for drop-by visits to our home. Once, when the girls were 2.5, Barb Bush made a rare stop in Midland. Jenna and Barbara ran out of the house with their arms held out to greet her, calling Ganny, the name all Bushes give to their grandmothers, and she looked up at me and said with gratitude, "Thank you for teaching your girls to know me." The roughly 100,000 square miles of Permian Basin land in West Texas and New Mexico are thought to hold significant portions of the United States oil and natural gas reserves. Midland, Texas, sits in the basin's geographic center. When oil was found, Midland was where the oil men came. Midland's first oil boom occurred during the 1920s. It sputtered back to life partway through the Great Depression. The 1950s were its golden age, the 1960s its crash. But by the mid-1970s, Midland had begun to rebound. The Arab oil embargo and long gas lines sent oil companies flocking back to Midland. From 1974 to 1981, Midland's bank deposits rose from $385 million to nearly $2 billion. The most successful oil man teed off at the country club in the middle of a weekday afternoon and gambled outrageous sums on every hole. Their wives glittered with diamonds. Rolls-Royce opened a Midland showroom. George and I lived a life far removed from this extravagant wealth. Our biggest indulgence was a membership in the Midland Country Club, although George did earn enough that I had the luxury of being able to stay home with the girls. Still, living in Midland in 1982 was like having drawn up a chair to a card game where the bettors at the table held a flush in every hand. George started in the oil business as a landman. He had moved to Midland in 1975 after he graduated from Harvard Business School. He spent hours combing courthouse records to determine who owned the mineral rights on a particular tract of land, which could be leased for oil well drilling. After he lost his 1978 congressional race, he started a small independent oil exploration business, Arbusto Energy. Arbusto is bush in Spanish. Independent oil men find and drill new wells. When prices are high, the risks are good ones. But at the start of 1983, oil prices in Texas plunged. A barrel of West Texas crude lost $5 in a single week in January. As opposed to $26 or $28 a barrel, it was now just over $19. The Midland banks began to fail. George was anxious about the future of his small company and his 7 employees. He merged with another larger company, Spectrum 7, in 1984. Oil prices briefly stabilized, then dropped again. We watched as drilling rigs went idle one by one. The top owners lost their vacation homes, their jets, even their desks, and their few spanking new computers that had been in their now empty buildings. But it wasn't just the wealthy oil men. Oil drilling is built on a scaffold of engineers, geologists, scientists, pipeline men and roughnecks, pumpers and roustabouts out in the field. They were among the first to be let go. Friends, acquaintances, and stalwarts around Midland edged toward ruin. The big oil I knew were the people who worked at decent jobs, who bought homes, sent their children to school, prayed in church, and pushed their shopping carts down the supermarket aisle next to mine. With that peculiar West Texas pluck, car bumpers sported stickers that read, "Please, Lord, let there be another boom. I promise I won't piss it away next time." George took a 25% pay cut, shaved whatever cost he could, and tried to hang on. We'd already been going to church since before the girls were born. It was where I felt, at last, the gentle embrace of faith again. Now some of our friends, like Don Evans and Don Jones, started a Wednesday night Bible study for men. George was one of the first to begin attending. Midland was a drinking town. After Prohibition was repealed, Midland County remained largely dry. Residents repeatedly voted against allowing alcohol sales. But that only changed how people drank. For years, liquor and mixed drinks couldn't be served in restaurants, but private clubs could pour a drink straight from the bottle, so people joined clubs, especially country clubs, where their individual bottles could be kept in their lockers. Vodka, bourbon, scotch, gin, anything with a kick, came out glass after glass. Those who didn't join clubs, like my father, simply drove to package stores at the county line and carried out their bottles in brown paper bags. At Johnny's Barbecue, Daddy could pour his own drinks from Johnny's private stash in the kitchen. All through my growing up, adults hosted dinner parties laced with cocktails and finished with nightcaps. More than once, men and women would weave their way from the hostess front steps to their cars and drive home. 2 decades out, almost nothing had changed. On Fridays, we usually ate Mexican food and the women drank margaritas and the men drank beer. On Saturdays, it was dinner at someone's home, usually a barbecue where everyone would bring something, appetizers, salads, desserts, and alcohol. There was wine, there was vodka, and there were mixed drinks, and we drank them. My father, who was retired, now liked to have a martini with lunch and a bourbon or two with dinner. George drank the three B's, a bourbon before dinner, a beer with dinner, and then B&B, a sweet after-dinner drink. It was lethal, and it was completely accepted, because that, or some version of it, was the drinking life of most men. George didn't have three drinks every night. Many times all he had was a beer. But when he'd poured enough, he could be a bore. Maybe it's funny when other people's husbands have had too much to drink at a party, but I didn't think it was funny when mine did, and I told him so. But I never said the line, "It's either Jim Beam or me." That joke came much later. I was not going to leave George, and I wasn't going to let him leave me with twins. Our marriage was enduring. We loved each other, and we were two people who did not have divorce in our DNA. But I was disappointed, and I let him know that I thought he could be a better man. In 1986, we planned a July trip to the Broadmoor in Colorado Springs to celebrate our 40th birthdays, and several friends came with us. The men played golf, and the women sunned by the pool. And on the last night, everyone, especially the men, ordered too much to drink at the bar. I heard the same toast repeated 20 times. I've joked that George quit the next day because he got the bar bill, but it was a combination of things. It was the fact of turning 40. It was the fact of his father being the vice president, and the expectation that Mr. Bush would run for president. None of the Bush children ever wanted to do anything to embarrass their dad. But it was also having talked with Billy Graham the summer he turned 39, when we were visiting his parents in Maine. And it was joining that Wednesday night Bible study in Midland, which fixed George's mind on a higher purpose. It was living through an oil bust, when people we knew had lost everything, and recognizing that failures are best met head-on, clear-eyed. And some of it was growing into being a father and a husband. There had been many drunken and half-drunken weekends. There was nothing out of the ordinary about this one, except that it was one weekend too many. It was to be the last one. Although George H.W. Bush was in his second term as vice president, George and I had not been invited to a single state dinner. As the Reagan administration ticked toward a close, a lovely embossed envelope with the perfect pen and ink calligraphy arrived, inviting us to a state dinner at the White House. It was one of the last dinners that the Reagans held, and it was on the same day the movers were coming to our house to load our boxes and start on the journey up to Washington, D.C. George H.W. Bush, the man our children called Gampy, was going to run for president, and his campaign manager, Lee Atwater, had asked George to move to Washington to work on his father's race. We were leaving Midland. I'd been working with the movers for over a month to arrange everything. Traveling to Washington for the dinner would require two plane flights and considerable expense. It seemed impossible to change our dates and rearrange everything. I called the White House's social secretary to decline, and she made a surprise sound into the other end of the phone. I've always traveled light. I look back on over 30 years of marriage, and aside from shelves of scrapbooks and books, we've accumulated startlingly few things. As we've moved, we've donated or given away many of our furniture pieces and rugs, even posters and paintings. I prefer to keep memories rather than things. Some of it is my dislike of clutter and its complications. Some of it comes from being a librarian, when I had to manage a collection. I had to catalog each piece, check bindings and repair tears. I culled the volumes, removing copies that had grown too tattered or worn. Every object had to pass through my fingertips. It has made me wary of the responsibility of too many things. We set off for Washington with a small moving van and our Pontiac sedan and Chevy station wagon, leaving behind our friends and our home. I had never lived outside of Texas for more than a few weeks. I was 41 years old. For more than 25 of those years, Midland had been my home. For more than 20 years, It had been George's. It was not just the pan-flat, arid land that we were leaving behind with each mile of road, but a way of being and of speaking. People in West Texas believe that they think differently, and to a large degree they do. There's a plainness to the way West Texas looks that translates into how people act and what they value. Those who live there are direct and blunt, to the point of hurt sometimes. There's no time for artifice. It looks and sounds ridiculous amid the barren landscape. From the era of the first settlers, people or animals could freeze or starve or roast if debates went on too long or too many niceties were observed. The West Texas plains were seared on each of us like an invisible brand. There, people adapted to the land. The land contoured them, not the other way around. When I married George, I had thought that I would be embraced by his mother every bit as much as he was embraced by mine. I had planned on being more a daughter than a daughter-in-law, but Barbara Bush had 5 children of her own. She was their defender first. What I came to see ultimately as our bond was that we both loved George, and the depth of our love was what we had in common. Beyond that, we had little contact. But from the start, she was also ferociously tart-tongued. She's never shied away from saying what she thinks, right up through Gampy's jump out of an airplane on his 85th birthday in June of 2009. He was set to land on the lawn next to St. Anne's Church in Kennebunkport, and Barr said, "If the jump doesn't go well, it'll be convenient. We can wheel him straight into his eternal resting place." I was with Barr in the mid-1990s when people would come up to us in a store or a restaurant in Kennebunkport and say, "I know you," thinking they'd met her somewhere. And her response was, "No, you don't. You don't know me." She's even managed to insult nearly all of my friends with one or another perfectly timed acerbic comment. Once, one of them, Lois Betts, called her on it, and Barr was truly chagrined. So I was a bit apprehensive about moving to Washington, where we would be living within walking distance of the senior Bushes, and George would effectively be working for his dad. But a decade after my marriage, Barr Bush and I finally got to know each other. We both loved reading and shared our favorite books, and Sundays became our family days. No matter how frenzied the campaign trail, both Bushes made sure that they were home together in the vice president's residence each Sunday afternoon. George and the girls and I would walk over for Sunday lunch. After years apart, George's parents got to know their son as an adult, and we had a window of time for us to be a small family, 2 people from each generation. The girls got to know their grandparents, not as flickering images on a TV screen, but as people who loved them. Gampy pushed them in a wooden swing hung from a tree on the grounds, and on rare nights off, he and Barr volunteered to babysit. At last, I saw Barr for who she is, a funny, warm woman, and a mother who is devoted to her husband and her children. Away from that overflowing Maine summer house, and the conventions and inaugurations, those high-profile, high-pitched events where Gampy's political career was on the line, Barr and I came to know and love each other. After 8 years of Reagan Bush, it was now George H.W. Bush at the top alone. Gampy won his election. I remember Jeb Bush saying a year or two later, "How great is this country that it could elect a man as fine as our dad is to be its president." When we married, George could recite the lineup from leading Major League Baseball teams circa 1950. He can still do it today. While George worked in oil, he had dreamed in baseball. One of George's partners in the oil business was a man named Bill DeWitt. Bill shared George's dream of owning a Major League Baseball team. Like Kevin Costner in the middle of those rows of Iowa corn, they had their own little field of dreams. When the Texas Rangers came up for sale in the late fall of 1988, Bill and George began putting together a group to buy the team, and we were moving to Dallas. It wasn't politics. It was sports and a game we now both loved. The first thing I put in my desk calendar each year was a list of the Texas Rangers home games, and we sat in the stands for nearly every one. Yet while we lived a very regular day-to-day life in Dallas, our eyes were never far from George's dad in Washington. George was assigned a Secret Service detail. We spent Christmas in the woods of Camp David, and our names were now on the guest list for lofty state occasions. But for the family of a president, there's another side. In August of 1990, the Iraqi president Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. George's dad had suddenly become a wartime president. We agonized for him. Even the quick victory and the Iraqi army's capitulation in Kuwait did not dim the private agonies he had faced sending young men and women into combat in harsh, unforgiving sands halfway across the world. After the Gulf War, Gampy was wildly popular, but the conflict had taken a toll. That spring, like Barr before him, he would develop Graves' disease, a thyroid condition. They both wondered if it was caused by some contaminant at the aging vice president's house. Gampy's mother was in faltering health, and he had a primary challenger in Pat Buchanan. The Democrats nominated the young Arkansas governor, Bill Clinton. But that was not the only opposition. The Texas billionaire Ross Perot joined the race as an independent. The epicenter of his campaign was Dallas. Perot opened a campaign office in an empty savings and loan building on a corner of Northwest Highway, directly in the line of sight from George's office. George would look out his window and see people we knew, people who were our friends and his dad's friends, walking into Ross Perot's building. He watched them walk in and essentially abandon his dad. Day after day, we saw George's father mocked and mischaracterized until we couldn't recognize the man we knew. With the vote split three ways in November 1992, Bill Clinton was elected the 42nd President of the United States. We had our last Christmas at the White House. Aside from a quick trip to visit George's brother, Marvin, or his sister, Daro, I did not expect to see Washington again. George signed up to run in the January 24th Houston Marathon. As the District of Columbia swept up after the Clinton inaugural revels, he was one of 5,000 runners looping around Houston. When the marathon was over, a new thought began to gel in his mind, the Texas governor's race. Ann Richards, the incumbent governor, was extremely popular. George was something of a known name, but a political unknown. But he believed she was vulnerable. He based his campaign on education. I listened, and I believed in him. From the moment he raised it with me, I never doubted that he would win. Now, in addition to Rangers home games, our lives were fixed on the lodestar of the Southwest Airlines flight schedule. From the first breakneck race of wheels along the tarmac toward takeoff in the morning to the last screech of rubber and reverse thrust at night, George was campaigning all over Texas. But because many of the events were in the day, and so much of the travel involved flying, he was usually home for dinner, lending a refreshing bit of normalcy to our lives. I did events as well, speaking to women's groups all around Dallas and sometimes joining George on the statewide hops. And when I wasn't his surrogate, I was the mother of 2 11-year-old girls with their myriad activities, friends, and pre-adolescent dramas. All the while, back in Midland, my father was slowly dying. In the winter of 1974, Johnny's barbecue had developed a leak in the roof. Daddy climbed up a rickety ladder to see if Johnny could pour a concrete roof, and when he stepped back on the ladder to come down, it gave way. Daddy fell and broke his ankle so badly that the doctor on call at the Midland Hospital thought the foot and ankle might have to be amputated. Daddy kept the foot, but his leg was never the same. 7 years later, he had the lung surgery, and a few years after that, the doctors found a second spot on his other lobe, so he had another operation, although this time they didn't need to remove so much lung. He quit smoking then, but I can still remember the day when he waited in the car while Mother, Jenna, Barbara, and I went to do an errand at a shopping center in Dallas. We came out and found him dozing, and as he slept, his fingers had drifted up to his shirt pocket and were trying to lift out an imaginary cigarette. He was dreaming of his tobacco and of the feel of the paper roll poised at the edge of his hand. Mother and Daddy still came to see us all those years. They flew up to Washington or over to Dallas, where they stayed in our little guest house out back. On one of their last visits, I was standing at my kitchen sink where the window gazed over the square of fenced backyard, and I saw them slowly making their way in from the guest house. I watched as, at the exact same moment, both of their faces lifted toward the sky. Grinning, laughing, they turned to each other, eyes catching, and then they looked up again. They were happy. No sadness ever unraveled their happiness. In the tiniest thing, they could find joy. That morning, it was our cat, Cowboy, who had climbed up on our roof, and they entered the kitchen smiling. What Mother noticed first was that Daddy could no longer fill out the bank deposit slips. He got all kinds of small checks, $1.50 royalties from an interest in some West Texas well, a rent check from a bus station that he had built in Odessa, stacks of checks for minuscule amounts, which were of great comfort to a man from the Depression. And he had always enjoyed going to the bank and depositing them until the paperwork became unmanageable. He would stare at the lines on the forms, a look of confusion washing over his face. Mother began to make the deposits for him. Then one day, Daddy walked into the house, set his car keys on the table, and announced that he was not going to drive again. He quit forever that afternoon. For years, his greatest fear had been that he would hit someone else's child. He would not risk that for a few more outings behind the wheel. But now all the driving fell to my mother. And then he began to fall. He was a large man, and Mother was tiny, and she had a very hard time getting him up. Sometimes she would call her neighbor across the street, and Trey would come, wrap his arms around Daddy's torso, and pull him off the floor. Gradually, he began falling so often that she had to call the local fire station at the very end of the street and ask the fireman to come lift him up. And she was afraid to take him places because she was scared that he would fall. Their world shrank as Daddy became more and more housebound. Friends visited. They came to Daddy when he could no longer come to them. That's one of the luxuries of living a long time in a small town. On election day, George donned his lucky tie, and we headed off to vote at Hillcrest High School in Dallas. He had his Department of Public Safety detail and an army of photographers and cameramen trailing him. He had everything but his wallet, with his voter registration card and driver's license. It was sitting on the bureau in our bedroom. He hustled back to retrieve his wallet, and then the officials waved him into the booth. That night, George won his race, while his brother Jeb lost a hard-fought vote in Florida to the incumbent governor, Lawton Chiles. 6 years after we had arrived in Dallas, we were packing to move into the governor's mansion. But before the inauguration, before we moved our reluctant newly turned 13-year-old seventh graders to Austin and to an entirely new school, we went home to Midland for Thanksgiving with Mother and Daddy. We were sitting in the living room, with its familiar green upholstery and the glass-top coffee table, when Daddy turned to me and said, "Who's that?" I looked over to where his head was pointing, took a breath, and replied, "That's my husband, Daddy. That's George Bush." And Daddy turned to me and said in an incredulous voice, "You married George Bush?" "Yes." Then he laughed his big, deep-throated laugh and said, "I think I'll ask him for a loan." Inauguration Day was cool and damp. George's family was all there, but Mother had come alone. We didn't know how we could ever get Daddy safely around the Capitol, or how she would manage when I was up on the platform with George. Then, when I arrived amid the crowd gathered at the Capitol, I saw a wheelchair at the edge of the family and dignitary section. Sitting in the chair was an elderly man, the close and dear relative who had raised Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock from the time he was a little boy. The Bullock family had gotten him there and had hired someone to push the chair, and my heart sank. We had not thought to do the same for Daddy, so that this boy from Lubbock might see his only daughter and his son-in-law become the First Lady and Governor of Texas. We had left him home with a helper and the television. When Mother returned, he told her, "You're so lucky. You're so lucky that you got to go." 3 months later, in late April, George and I were standing on the grounds of the Alamo as part of the Historic Site's annual pilgrimage, a pilgrimage they've held since 1925, in which, after a muted procession, a floral wreath is laid, and the names of the Alamo's defenders are solemnly read from inside the mission's stone walls. My new chief of staff, Andy Ball, came running up with the news that my father had collapsed and been rushed to the hospital. I raced to the airport and boarded the next Southwest Airlines flight to Midland. Daddy had already been under the care of a hospice, which provided tremendous comfort to my mother and to him. But on that afternoon, the hospice nurse had already come and gone. Mother was getting something in the kitchen, and Daddy's aide was feeding him some soup when suddenly she shrieked. Mother came running to find that Daddy had collapsed. Hospice was closed, the aide was overwrought, and Mother later said that she panicked and dialed 911. Daddy lived 5 more days before starvation and dehydration took him, early in the morning on April 29, 1995. I spent those days with Mother in his hospital room. We held his hand. We talked to him. We planned his funeral and wrote his obituary, the words never coming close to capturing the man. George and the girls flew in to tell him goodbye. Mother said later that she would never have forgiven herself for dialing 911 if they had brought Daddy back and he had lingered in pain. He had a living will, but he seemed not to be suffering until the last breath departed from his lungs. Daddy's funeral was on a Monday. Later that week, I was back in Austin. My days were crowded. I did not have too much time to dwell on memories until Christmas, when we played our home movies of the girls as babies, and Daddy's face and arms flashed across the frames. And for years afterward, even now, I would dream of Daddy, and in my dreams, he is well. Ann Richards was not married when she was governor, so there'd been no first spouse in Texas for 4 years. I had a small office in the new underground space behind the Capitol building, which was across the street from the governor's residence. But what was my business? Rita Clements, the state's most recent First Lady, had a long list of accomplishments in her chosen causes: volunteerism, education, historic preservation, and tourism. Where would my mark be made? Some months after George became governor, an El Paso writer named Robert Skimmon made an appointment to see me in my office. He told me that he'd attended a state book festival in Kentucky, and that he'd always wanted Texas to have its own book festival, adding, "You'd be the perfect person to start it, since you were a librarian." We got permission to hold it in the Capitol, with tents outside for authors to meet readers and sell books, and monies we raised were to go to Texas public libraries. And authors wanted to come. Larry McMurtry of Lonesome Dove fame told a story of how his hometown of Archer City, Texas, did not have a public library until he helped start one with some of his book profits. The playwright, Larry L. King, said that when he was growing up poor in Midland, the public library had saved him. His childhood forays into the works of Mark Twain had led him to dream of telling stories rather than roughnecking it in the oil fields. But even after all the authors said yes, I was anxious. Weeks before the event, I lay awake at night and worried. What if the weather turned bad? What if the encampment of white tents blew over? The same weekend, Austin was hosting a beer festival and a gun and knife show. One newspaper article quoted an unnamed author as saying, "Great, everyone will be drunk and armed." I was worried that no one would come. The festival opened in the House chamber, and then the authors fanned out to read in various committee rooms around the Capitol. Outside the House chamber, as the events were getting underway, a jackhammer was ripping up the ground. I flagged down someone to tell the construction crew to stop, but then I began to worry about all the other things we had forgotten. My head started to pound, and I slipped back across the street to the governor's mansion and got into bed. I was sure the whole festival was going to be a bust, and people would leave as soon as they had arrived. Reagan and another friend of mine, Pam Nelson, came over to the house and found me. They excitedly told me, "The festival is going great. Come back." So I got up, redressed, and raced back across to the Capitol. It was standing room only to listen to the authors in the committee rooms, and there were long lines in the tents. I bought the books of the authors who weren't selling many copies and walked around. Over the weekend, nearly 15,000 people came to the first annual Texas Book Festival. In its first 14 seasons, the festival has given over $2.3 million to Texas libraries. Even though George was the governor of the second largest state in the nation, I had considerable freedom as his wife, and there was a great normalcy to my life in Austin. A couple of nights after dinner, Reagan and Billy and I would walk over to stand at Antone's to listen to Bobby Blue Bland, just as we'd always done. Many mornings I would walk south on Colorado Street and around Austin's Town Lake, now renamed for Lady Bird Johnson, with my friend Nancy Weiss. I stood in line alone for coffee in the Capitol cafeteria or for stamps at the post office, and when people caught sight of my DPS detail in the State House, they swivel their heads about, looking for the famous person who must be somewhere about the room. Barbara and Jenna loved to tell the story of the time we were standing in a checkout line at Walmart in Athens, Texas, near our little weekend getaway lake house, and a woman kept staring at me. Finally, she said, "I think I know you." And I replied, "I'm Laura Bush." As if, the girls liked to point out, of course she would know who I was. Her answer was, "No, guess not." Even our family life held on to normalcy. The four of us ate dinner together most nights, and George routinely helped the girls type and proofread their term papers. When ninth grade came, Barbara and Jenna opted to go to Austin's large downtown public high school. The second year of George's term was also the year of George's and my 50th birthdays. We celebrated under the stars with heaps of dripping barbecue and lots of toasts. Then the lieutenant governor, Bob Bullock, stood up. Bob, a Democrat, toasted George as the man who will be the next president of the United States. It was July of 1996. George hadn't even been reelected governor. But by the following year, talk had turned to the presidency. I waited before I weighed in, because I knew both sides of what that decision would entail. In 1993, George H.W. Bush invited me and several other children and in-laws to accompany him on a trip to Kuwait. On the way home, we stopped in France to see President François Mitterrand, who escorted us all through the recently opened Euro Disney, the Disneyland of Europe. We rode on Space Mountain. We tried the famous rides and attractions, but at one point during the afternoon, I was walking ahead and turned around. Behind me was the threesome of Gampy, Ganny, and Mitterrand, but they seemed larger than life, the way celebrities, when one sees them in person, look like the animation of 1,000 paparazzi stills. In that instant, Gampy, Ganny, and Mitterrand appeared as fantastical as movie stars, ambling through Euro Disney, and they were every bit as recognizable. While as the years lengthened, their prominence might dim, they would still never sit in a restaurant or a cafe, or an airline seat, and pass unrecognized. There was no chance for them to be anonymous again.